What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who's been covering the NBA Finals at GQ 538 and wherever else you get your NBA news. Michael, we have a series. We thought we were about to escape the bubble, but Jimmy Butler pulled us back in. A big Game 3 win for the Miami Heat. Didn't really see it coming. My mind, we were already well down the path towards a Los Angeles Lakers sweep and sort of an anticlimactic and inevitable conclusion to this grueling bubble. But Jimmy Butler had other ideas. He had a 40-point triple-double in the finals. I looked up the list last night. As far as I could tell, it's just Jimmy, LeBron, and Jerry West to have a 40-point triple-double in the NBA Finals. That is pretty special. On top of that, I think there was a real measure of revenge for Jimmy against LeBron, and he spoke about that a little bit in his post-game comments, basically saying, look, I've lost enough to this guy, and we've got a new team, and I think he was actually trying to rally the troops and saying, look, we're going to go out there and even this series on Tuesday at two games apiece. So from the Heat perspective, it's this wild change of momentum where they figured things out defensively, and Jimmy Butler's unstoppable, and now maybe they get Bam back. Everything is lining up. You go to the Lakers post-game press conference, and LeBron says, quote-unquote, we're not concerned. It was just about the foul trouble for Anthony Davis. It was just about the really loose turnovers that LeBron had, tying a season high of 8 turnovers in that game. And they basically view it like they shot themselves in the foot. Let's start there. How much credit does Miami get for this Game 3 win versus how much blame do we give the Lakers? How do you parse that out, like, from a percentage basis?
Yeah, this is always a really tough question. I mean, I'm almost at 50-50 here because I don't want to discredit the Miami Heat for showing the fight that they did. And Jimmy's performance was spellbinding and, you know, iconic, basically, instantly iconic. On the other hand, like, the Lakers should be totally embarrassed about losing a winnable game and clearly not exerting the defensive force and intensity in this one that they normally have throughout the entire postseason.
Way too polite, Michael. I'm going 20% Heat, 80% Lakers. What were the Lakers doing in Game 3? Come on.
No, I did not expect, or I did expect that exact response from you, so I had to temper it a little bit on my end. But look, the early turnovers from basically every member of the Los Angeles Lakers were so sloppy. They were unforced. I mean, there's really nothing else you can say like that Miami did to force those. It was just the Lakers not treating it like the NBA Finals is kind of how I saw it when I was watching the game. Their offense late was clogged toilet. They didn't really make any effort at all in the fourth quarter to get Anthony Davis involved. So, yeah, it was not a fine showing from
the
Lakers.
Well, you know, LeBron had that tweet that was like, oh, I'm having a hard time sleeping. I think his mind was going so hard. I mean, it did look like maybe the entire team had just been subjected to 48 hours of sleep deprivation, you know, in that first half, where it's like, hey, good luck. Go out there and play a finals game without sleeping for 3 days, right? Look, the turnovers reminded me, there was that stretch. Do you remember in the Western Conference Finals where Denver had like 5 straight live ball turnovers and we were all sitting around like, I've never seen this since middle school. The Lakers topped it. Like, their turnovers were more ridiculous, more inexplicable. They weren't even forced. It wasn't like, you know, where Rondo was like running up on Jamal Murray and causing him to freak out a little bit. This was just like coming across half court and Bron just sailing passes in every direction. It did feel a little bit like his passing and vision compass was broken, like maybe somebody put a magnet near it or something like that. He was just completely thrown off kilter. Very, very strange situation. And the worst part of it was for the Lakers, both of their superstars were involved with kind of these, like, you know, crazy, you know, once a playoff performance stinker, right? Because with Anthony Davis, it was the early foul trouble, the quick ticky-tack calls, and then as soon as he gets back in, after getting 2 in the first quarter, he gets the third pretty quickly. And as soon as the third quarter starts, he gets his fourth pretty quickly. And he's just looking around like, is there nothing I can do on the court without somebody, you know, calling these fouls on me? Is that what you attribute his poor game to? Or was there anything else going on? Because if we just rewind back to Game 2, I think most people would have started to agree with you. He's looking like the leader for Finals MVP. He's completely unstoppable. They don't have Bam coming back for Game 3. you know, who's going to be the matchup. I mean, did it wind up being that Scott Foster was just too tough a matchup for Anthony Davis?
I do think that the foul trouble certainly bothered him, certainly took him out of his rhythm. That's not really, I don't want to excuse the game from him. I mean, it was a bad game from Anthony Davis. And you kind of contrast it with game two and just earlier performances in this series where, you know, he's like the guy locking down Jimmy Butler as the primary defensive assignment. He's the guy just absolutely erasing every opportunity in the paint. He's the guy who's tip dunking every single Laker miss. Like, so I think that, you know, there are ways for you to impact the game physically, even if you're not involved in the offensive game plan, which he wasn't down the stretch, which is not necessarily his fault. But he was not the same force on the glass that he's been. He wasn't the same force just like basically setting screens. Like, he just was kind of roaming around on both ends, really petrified, I thought, to pick up that fifth and that sixth foul. And I thought that the entire Lakers team was sensitive to his foul trouble as well. And you just look at, it's kind of late when there was one play in the fourth quarter where AD actually switched onto Jimmy Butler, and it was a switch that the Heat wanted. And Alex Caruso was helping so far off of Tyler Hero that Jimmy could just hit him one pass away for a wide open three. And Caruso's mindset there is basically, I don't want Jimmy to drive here and to potentially have AD be in an awkward situation where he basically has to commit a foul or is in danger of committing a foul. So I think the foul trouble did matter. But at the end of the day, like, you know, there was a lot of issues with LeBron, I thought, defensively, and that I'm sure we can go into. But, like, I don't know. I mean, I just thought it was really weird that they didn't involve AD down the stretch when he has a matchup advantage, a gross matchup advantage on whoever's on him in this series.
No, for sure. And they were really slow to involve him in the first quarter, too. I mean, it wasn't just the fouls. It was his lack of involvement in the offense that just started him really, really flat. I don't think he scored until he actually came back in the second quarter. I'm not even sure he took a shot. There's no way that that's going to happen again. You know, in game four, that's going to be the primary adjustment, I'm sure, is going to be to force feed Anthony Davis early and get him going because of that matchup advantage. I'm also glad you mentioned the idea of his interior defense, because we've really seen that length cause problems for all sorts of ball handlers throughout this playoff run. And this just, you know, endless loop of Jimmy Butler battering ram layups straight down the paint all the way to the glass. Let's get to the free throw line. You know, half the time he's just like laying prone on the court after absorbing contact from somebody. I mean, that kind of, you know, consistent foray down the middle of their defense is just something that we've really never seen. And that's why Anthony Davis is there, right? To scare people away from doing that. And yet Jimmy just does it over and over and over to the tune of 40 points, I believe 11 rebounds and 13 assists. What a monster game. I want to explain a little bit for people who may not remember this, why this was such a satisfying win for Jimmy Butler. A little background historical context. If you go back to 2013, you know, Jimmy is basically a 23-year-old defensive stopper, second round series between the Chicago Bulls and the Miami Heat. And Jimmy's job is to run around the court, and he played all 48 minutes, did not sit for a single second under Coach Tom Thibodeau in three of those five games over the course of a 10-day span, Michael. And he chased LeBron around and chased LeBron around, and ultimately the Heat prevailed. They went on to win the title that year. LeBron was the Finals MVP. 2 years later, Jimmy's still, you know, kind of banging away at the drum in Chicago. There's been some injuries with Derrick Rose and all that stuff. They get into a second round series, and LeBron's on Cleveland now. Chicago, the heavy underdog in that series, goes up 2-1 with a miraculous buzzer beater by Derrick Rose, three-pointer out of nowhere. The Cavaliers at that moment were dealing with all sorts of injury issues. They looked super vulnerable. You get to a very tense game four. You might remember this David Blatt, Cavaliers coach, wanders onto the courts trying to call timeout. The referees don't see it. He's trying to design a final play where LeBron's going to inbound. LeBron says, sorry, David Blatt, I'm going to get you fired in 9 months. And by the way, we're definitely not going to run that play. Here's my play. Inbound the ball to me. If you go back and watch the buzzer beater that LeBron hits in game four to even that series, he kind of shoves off of Jimmy Butler, gets himself open, and drains that shot right in Jimmy's face. And he does it at the United Center crowd, silencing the entire crowd. Now, the Cavaliers then went on to win games 5 and 6 to finish off that series, basically snuffing out another hope for the Bulls to advance. And Jimmy only wins one playoff series combined in the next 4 years after that. And he also lost the first two games of this final series. So after that LeBron buzzer beater, Jimmy had lost 5 straight head-to-head playoff games against LeBron, in addition to having already previously lost the 2 playoff series that they had been matched up in. So this is not like LeBron versus KD, or like LeBron versus Steph, or a LeBron versus Kawhi Leonard type rivalry. But if you're on the wrong side of LeBron throughout the course of your career and you go like 5 straight years without a chance to like get back at him, you have to realize how sweet this particular victory was for Butler, because it was clearly the game of his life. They needed the game of his life to be able to get over a team that was clearly favored. I'm sure you saw that stat bouncing around that Jimmy's the first player to record more points, rebounds, and assists in the same game, I think, in the playoffs compared to LeBron. That's a ridiculous accomplishment. Maybe just, you know, put that, first line of his obituary 50 years from now. I mean, that's, something you could definitely write home about. So I think for Miami's side, you do want to temper your expectations, because so many things went wrong for the Lakers. Like, the most likely outcome of the series to me is still Lakers in 5. However, Jimmy Butler waited more than 5 years, really, to have this moment, and it was quite the moment.
Long live Jimmy. Legendary performance. I think that the Miami Heat might consider hanging that Mark Spears tweet in the rafters of their arena, showing that Jimmy was the first player ever to outplay LeBron in points, rebounds, and assists in a finals game. Jimmy is there's this article that might be up already by the time our listeners hear this on 538 that I've been working on about how LeBron has been hunting the right matchups that he wants, using guards to set screens for him. This is something that we talked about after game one, you and I. Last night, what was so amazing to me was that's exactly what Jimmy Butler did in the fourth quarter. Basically, every touch that he had, LeBron was guarding him, and they brought up either Tyler Hero or Duncan Robinson, Kendrick Nunn when he was on the floor, and Jay Crowder to set screens for Jimmy to get the right matchup. And it was completely out of the norm for how the Miami Heat, their egalitarian offense, kind of normally operates, even in crunch time, where Jimmy doesn't take over like that usually. That's just not who he is. So to see Jimmy kind of transform into LeBron with the season on the line, their backs against the wall, and succeed the way he did, was awesome. It was just really cool to watch, and you just can't help but be so pumped for Jimmy Butler right now.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you come on here all the time preaching the gospel of Eric Spoelstra, and we all know you love Bam. do you consider yourself like a Jimmy Butler guy? He is a player who I first profiled in 2015. I think it was his first cover story. It was my first cover story at Sports Illustrated. I really enjoyed the process of talking to him back then, because he was just getting his first taste of success and fame. It was his breakout Most Improved Player season. He was kind of getting in the All-Star mix. He knew he had a big contract waiting for him in the summer. He had famously said he was going to bet on himself and basically double what the Bulls were kind of offering him, with the course of the play that season. And, you know, guys change once they're famous. It just always happens. Of course, his career went a lot of different directions in the ensuing 5 years. But there is a ruthless competitor, there's a guy who's been through a lot of childhood trauma, who I think wears it, you know, in all of his relationships. I think there's a guy who's finally found a home in Miami that feels like it will be a long-term fit after, you know, a long time of searching for it. And it's a player who, you know, I'm not sure we would ever consider to be an all-time great. Like, he's not going to get into that conversation. But here he is having a very memorable postseason run, knocking off the Milwaukee Bucks, you know, taking care of the Boston Celtics, you know, multiple teams that you would probably say were favored in those series, and doing it his way, right? And, you know, is it going to lead to a title? Probably not. Is it going to lead to probably the deepest satisfaction of his career? I imagine so. And I'm just curious, like, are you a Jimmy guy? Do you view it like that, or have you always... Or have you at all like bought into the anti-Jimmy voices? And there are many who say, come on, this guy's a malcontent. He doesn't play nice with others. He doesn't, you know, he'll bully his teammates. He doesn't make everyone better. You know, he's trying to kind of guilt trip people into acting a certain way. You know, he's too macho of an alpha and all that stuff. I mean, this has been a polarizing figure in the NBA. And right now it's like kind of his moment. It's his validating moment, right?
Yeah. So I think, you know, my perspective on Jimmy is unique in a similar vein to what you were saying about how you wrote a cover story about him right as he was kind of coming into his own in Chicago. I traveled to Calabasas the summer before he went to Minnesota. So he was already traded. He was on the Timberwolves, but he had yet to play a game there. And I hung out with him for a couple days at his mansion in Calabasas/Malibu. And like ever since then, I've just been such a Jimmy believer. Like, he is, he's just, the intensity is obviously there.
So, Michael, is this why you're an early morning person? I mean, you told us at one time it was about a trip to Asia that got you onto your early morning cycle. But is it really that you were just waking up at 4 a.m. to work out with Jimmy and now you're, you know, you believe in that stuff?
No, actually, during that reporting trip, I declined the opportunity to wake up at 5:30 in the morning and go to the beach with him. So no, that was not at that stage in my life. I was still kind of wanting to get up when I wanted to get up. He's like, I just remember, you know, hanging around, doing a photo shoot, just watching, observing him by the swimming pool, you know, drinking beers. And later on, like, when it was just me and him, we went into this like private movie theater and in the house, and he has, you know, he shuts the door, doesn't let the publicist in. He's like super, just like awesome. I don't even know. It was such an opportunity that rarely comes about, as you know, where like, I know I'm getting a little inside baseball here, but to be one-on-one for over an hour with a guy who's completely letting it all out. And
who's very charming and has a lot to
very,
say.
Very charming, has a lot to say. You know, right as we sit down in the seats, you know, he gets up, he walks over to grab a blanket, asks me if I'm cold.
This is getting a little romantic, Michael. What's happening?
No, that's what you sure, yeah. This is the beginning of my love affair with Jimmy Butler. And so, like, I've just always admired a lot of his strengths and kind of looked over, like, the way he explained himself to me and the way he explained his behavior, because that was at the beginning of, okay, he's a little, you know, it was Jimmy Butler versus Fred Hoiberg at that time, and the Bulls clearly chose Fred Hoiberg. And asking him about that, asking him about kind of being disgruntled with teammates a little bit, which was a very real thing. And like seeing it from his point of view and his explanation, and basically, which was, I work exceptionally hard. I don't take anything for granted. When I see people in this league who do not work as hard as me, it aggravates me. And it's really hard to look at that and not like agree with where he's coming from, right? And so that's why, you know, systems and cultures and fits, they're all so important. And so for Jimmy to go to Miami, where everybody else is working exceptionally hard, and if you don't work hard, you don't play or you get traded, it just made so much sense for him. And so it's really cool to see him succeed now in a place where just, you know, it's just a match made in heaven, and so much about basketball is context related at this level. And so that's why I know we're going to rank these guys in a minute, but that's why ranking Jimmy is so difficult, because it's real hard to separate the situation he's in from who he is as a player, if that makes any sense. I think he's a really great player. I think the situation and how he's handled it just elevates him to a different level.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially like this Paul George versus Jimmy conversation, the one thing you can say about Jimmy is that he's squeezed every single ounce out of his potential and out of his gifts, and he will never leave you feeling like, well, Paul George, you know, didn't quite get over the hump this year. Is he ever going to get over the hump? Is he trustworthy? Like, you know exactly what you're getting with Jimmy, and to me, that's a real virtue, and it's something that can sometimes get underrated relative to pure talent, right? We fall in love with the pure talent and we think, well, a guy's a little bit longer, he's got a smoother jump shot, you know, he's smoother on the ball, well, maybe that
shoots
means he's going to be a, right, shoots three pointers, yeah, and shoots them well. All those things can kind of, you know, distract you a little bit, but there is clearly, as we saw last night, a lot of value to doing it Jimmy's way. Now, we're also kind of judging him right now, you know, at the very peak of his career. You always got to be careful of judging a guy based on his best day or his worst day. But this was kind of like the clearest articulation of his value. To double back on the whole, he needs the right work ethic, he needs the right culture thing. I will play amateur psychologist here and just say that stuff is deeply rooted in his personality because of his childhood. As his adoptive mother told me in 2015, he developed this mentality as a high schooler, essentially when he was homeless and couch surfing from place to place, that basically he could not stop or slow down, or life and you know, expectations and responsibilities and maybe his own behaviors would catch up with him. So it was in those formative years that he kind of came up with this like all gas, no brakes mentality, where just like, you know, he just felt like he had to stay one step ahead, and he got into some trouble when he was in high school. And if that family had not stepped in and adopted him, it was one of his high school teammates and the family basically just let him live with them for a pretty extended period of time. Had he not had that, there are some very clear alternative histories here where we have no idea who Jimmy Butler is, right? And his relationships with both of his parents were kind of strained at that point of his life. I think he's made some progress on you know, repairing those relationships with his biological parents, and I, you know, give him a lot of credit for doing that. He does not talk about it a lot. It's clearly still something that he holds, you know, very dear. But, you know, at the same time, when you're going through that kind of a lifestyle where you're, you know, living hand to mouth, a lot of times he didn't know if he was going to have lunch. You know, he's almost like practically asking people, can I share your, you know, bag of chips or something like that, you know, in high school. I mean, some, you know, really traumatic moments there. I think it also leads to a lack of trust, obviously, right? And I think it also leads to the potential for emotional outbursts, because when you're constantly living kind of a paranoid or fearful lifestyle, you don't have a level of stability, and you don't, the people who you're supposed to be able to trust aren't there for you, that warps your personality basically forever. And so you can see a lot of times when he gets into situations with authority figures, he either bonds with them because, you know, he is able to kind of get over it, and then it's like the deepest trust you could ever possibly imagine. I think you know, his college coach Buzz Williams is a perfect example of a guy who got through to Jimmy, who was really hard on him and who was able to establish that connection. Hoiberg, the exact opposite personality, never had a shot, right? And it's just another example of terrible Bulls management and ownership, you know, thinking that this was going to be the guy to connect with Butler. Never in a million years, right? That relationship was doomed from the start. It's no surprise that Spoelstra, right, and Thibodeau are the kinds of coaches who are going to see eye to eye with Jimmy. It's also no surprise, especially in hindsight, that players like Karl Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, and Ben Simmons weren't going to be able to make it work with Jimmy. It's just there's psychologically, he's not able to kind of bond with every single person out there. You know, he is very brash, he is very confrontational, And he's also not afraid to burn bridges, in part because of what I was describing about his childhood, almost like nomadic lifestyle, where you have the luxury of just continuing to move from spot to spot to spot, because that's how you've sort of been living your entire life. And you don't even worry about burning bridges. That's no longer a priority. You know, for most of us, we want to leave most situations on good terms. I think with Jimmy, he says, whatever, screw it. I'm only focused on the future. And, you know, there's that whole story. Oh, he took the rear view mirrors out of his minivan, right? Because he didn't want to have to look backwards. And a lot of this stuff, I think to outsiders, it almost seems like a joke or it's over the top. And, you know, Jimmy is a goofy guy. He does lean into his eccentricities for sure. But at the same time, like, that is very symbolic of who he is as a person. Like, if 29 teams were fed up with him and said, oh, he ruined our franchises, right? Like, you know, the Minnesotas and the Phillies of the world, oh, he left us in ruins, blah, blah, blah. I think he would be fine with it as long as he had that one team left that he could go to and start fresh, right? And that's unique. There's not very many even high-level NBA players who have that type of mentality. You just don't see it. It makes him stand out from the crowd.
When you're as confrontational also as he is, and he is very confrontational, that's his nature with his best friends, with people he doesn't know.
So he was screaming at you in that movie theater?
He was not, but I witnessed him giving it to everyone else who was there for a majority of the time, be it the photographer, be it just his friends when they were playing dominoes. Where you don't even know sometimes if he's joking because he's not smiling. And like even his closest friends and his confidants were, it gets like a little uncomfortable, I think, sometimes.
He's constantly testing people.
Exactly. And so if you want to have that type of persona, you need to back it up with your production and your skill level. if you're a professional basketball player, you will be ostracized.
I'm not even sure if I should tell this. I'll just give a short version of it. I got my fill of that. I was doing some fact checking on that magazine story, and it's annoying. You know, I mean, it's not fun. You know, picture the most painful, surgical procedure or doctor's visit that you can imagine, and that's sort of what the magazine fact checking process was like, especially back in 2015. And so I needed him to confirm a few details after we had already sat down for multiple hours of interviews and all this stuff. And he lost his stuff on me, man. He flipped out. He was screaming. He was cussing me out. Again, this is pretty unusual, I would say. He's just yelling at me on the phone. And, you know, I let him go for a while. I thought he would get over it, and he just was not getting over it. And, you know, eventually I basically had to, like, curse back at him, which is absolutely not in my nature. I think our listeners know that I don't think I ever curse on this podcast. At least I haven't for years and years. I make a point not to. And every once in a while, you know, I'll let an F-bomb off in real life, but certainly not at an NBA player when we're arguing about fact checks for a magazine. But it was like the only way to get through to him. It was like, look, dude, you don't know who I am, so shut the bleep up. We're going to work through this process, and you're going to get your cover. And like, I'm sitting over there imagining you're like, you can't even picture that happening, but it happened. It was the only way that we could get to the finish line. And, you know, no hard feelings. I think it's fine. But it was unique, I guess I put it that way. And whenever like young journalists always ask me like, what's the most challenging interview you've ever had? I do go back to that one because like the stakes of that story, you know, do you want to be on the cover or not? Like this is something that you've wanted. Like this is a major moment of validation for you. It's going to have that Chicago Bulls red. It's going to be on newsstands all across the country. You're going to want to blow it up and put it in your house probably. But you're going to need to like help me answer these three questions or the whole thing falls apart. And he was just so stubborn that he couldn't get over that mental hurdle for a good 30 or 40 minutes. So that's my short version of Jimmy Butler. I'm sure a lot of people have even more entertaining and, you know, elaborate, confrontations along the way.
Can I jump in real quick for 2 seconds? When I was sitting down with him during our extended chat, I thought that I was going to get that side of Jimmy with some of the questions I had prepared. you know, I was reading quotes back to him from people like Fred Hoiberg and from younger players on the Bulls who were displeased with his temperament throughout his tenure there.
He invites you to his private movie screening and you're just trolling him with annoying questions to see if he's going to flip out on you. He gave you a blanket, Michael. What are you doing?
I turned down the blanket, but... He, you know, I was trying to ask real journalistic questions. I didn't want it to be, you know, letting him just kind of fuel the narrative, which he really wanted to do. And I mean, he answered them like all the questions with like eloquence and depth and honesty, I thought. And he wasn't ever angry at me. So maybe it was because you were doing it over the phone, and maybe I have no idea. Maybe he just liked me because I'm such a personable person. But
these were particularly personal questions. That's how I'll put it, and that's what upset him. And I think it was also just that like the story had seemingly been done for a couple weeks, and we were just like finally ready to run it out for the midseason report. And it's kind of this blindside thing of like, hey, by the way, we have like three more things we need you to do, and that's obviously a hassle. And look, bottom line is it's a hassle for the writers too. I can promise you that. Like those last second fact checks will just ruin your whole week, but. They're important. Facts do matter. And, you know, it's worth getting screamed at every once in a while. You get a good story out of it.
Sure.
All right. Here's a couple of quick ranking questions for you. Let's start with this one. I think it's more fun. It's a little more devious, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago Bulls, Minnesota Timberwolves, Philadelphia 76ers. You can be their owners. You can be their fan bases. Who had the most painful time watching Jimmy go absolutely nuts in Game 3, knowing that it could have potentially been for their team if they just happened to have something resembling Heat culture and they could have kept him happy? Who's having the roughest watch for Game 3?
I'll start with the easiest watch because I think that that is the most simple, straightforward answer, and that would be the Minnesota Timberwolves, because I'm sure that they would have loved to have Jimmy for the long term, but Jimmy kind of broke up with them before they had a chance to break up with him. You know what I mean? Like, they max out Andrew Wiggins, which is just like a colossal, terrible decision for a variety of reasons. And that kind of set him off. It was like, you're going to pay this dude who does not work as hard as me this much money. That also extended to Karl-Anthony Towns, although I think that the Karl-Anthony Towns contract was totally valid. So I think that that's like, you know, it's bad for the Timberwolves fans. I'm sure they don't feel great about watching Jimmy Butler be the best player on a team that is three wins away from winning the NBA championship. But I don't think it compares to the other two.
So my thought on that real quick is just that, you know, they usually say, oh, a locker room can handle like one bad apple, right? And, you know, as long as you don't have two, you're going to be able to be okay and get along. I feel like Jimmy can handle one nice guy, not two. And if it had only been Carl, and it hadn't been Carl and Andrew, especially with Andrew's contract, I think that that could have worked better, or at least he would have had a little bit longer of a buy-in, because mm-hmm. I think he would have felt like he could have exerted more pressure on Carl, and him and Tibbs together could build Carl up maybe, and there would have been some way that that could have worked out just a little bit more successfully. But I think when you're sitting and staring and realizing, look, the next 5 years of your career are going to be, you know, spent working in around these two guys. Are they the right two guys? You could just tell why he would not come to that conclusion, especially when you're comparing that to his treatment of, say, Embiid or Tyler Hero or guys who he feels like are completely all the way bought in, competitive, and on the same page as him. You can understand that. I also think this idea, you know, they talk about Minnesota nice. Jimmy, not Minnesota nice, right? There's some clear philosophical approaches to life that are just inherently different. And by the way, same thing for Thibodeau. And talking to people with the Timberwolves who were around that organization during that time period, they were all miserable, not because of Jimmy, but largely because of Thibodeau's approach and just his demeanor and how he handled things and his power and his influence. And so I think that the Jimmy thing was just a byproduct of that. So I agree. I think that they would rather lose without Jimmy than win with Jimmy and Thibodeau, to be honest.
But also, like, they're in a fine situation now, right? Like, they can, you know, they're perpetually building towards the future, which is very frustrating. But I think the position that the Timberwolves and, like, their fans should be fine with where they're at, all things considered.
Okay, I agree. So we're on the same page so far. You've nailed it. This is where it gets tricky, though. Who's next?
Yeah.
Philly or Chicago?
This is tough. I went back and forth on this. I think next up, if we're just going in the order of least painful to most painful, next up for me is the Bulls.
Disagree.
And okay. I think that, look, the Bulls were the first team to not believe that Jimmy could be the best player on a title team. And they have been a complete train wreck. For a variety of reasons, you know, not just because they traded Jimmy. There's no saying that if they kept Jimmy, they would have success, because I think that the front office and ownership and all that has been pretty tough. And, you know, coaching decisions as well probably would not have gone the way that they did. But at the end of the day, like, their franchise philosophy was that Jimmy is not the guy, and Jimmy is the guy. So that's tough. That's a tough pill to swallow.
So I think Chicago deserves to be the team that feels the worst about this. And here's why. It's just been an utter disaster since he left. They have nothing that they could possibly spin in their favor about, oh, well, at least we have this. Like, at least we have this. Like, if you're Philly, you can say, well, we still have Embiid. We still have enough cachet to make the second round of the playoffs and be one Kawhi shot away from a conference finals. You could still say, hey, you know, so you got some payoff, some real payoff from the Butler experience. You can still say, hey, we have enough cachet to get Doc as our coach. Look, you and I know Philly's headed for kind of a dark and disappointing, you know, next 5 years. And they certainly made the wrong choice between Jimmy or Tobias, or Jimmy and Simmons, if you want to look at it that way. However you want to say they should have put that team together, it backfired, right? But if you're Chicago, you've already had that entire five-year experience of losing Jimmy and not really being able to build around it. And you also have to look back, and history will judge you for taking Hoiberg instead of Jimmy. Hoiberg is a guy who may never get another chance as an NBA head coach. People are going to look back and say, they had Jimmy Butler, who they could have, you know, put almost any coach around, built this entire organization around, found a way to remold in his image, and been a consistent playoff team, right? Instead, they brought out Fred Hoiberg and Jim Boylan and turned their organization over to two of the least successful coaches with the strangest personalities that we've seen in the last decade. That was your move? That was your big plan. And not only that, it worked out so badly that you finally had to fire a long entrenched front office and start from scratch in a situation that, to me, is going to take another 3 to 5 years to get to a reasonable perspective. Had they just built around Jimmy like Houston was building around James Harden at the same time. And by the way, I was writing this in 2016 and 2017 because Houston was really showing, hey, look, if you cater to the star, if you understand who he is, if you know his strengths and weaknesses, if you bring in like-minded people, you'll have some level of success. Is that ever going to have turned that Chicago team into, you know, a championship contender? Probably not. Would they have ever made it as far as this Miami Heat team? Probably not. How much of Miami's current run is boosted by the bubble circumstances? I would say some of it. But Chicago has been completely irrelevant since the moment they traded Jimmy Butler. They got completely fleeced in that particular trade, and they're going to be irrelevant for another 5 years going forward. I think that they've got to look at that Jimmy Butler experience and think, God, we had this guy. We drafted him. We developed him. We had the coach who understood him, you know, his first love as an NBA coach, you know, Tom Thibodeau, and we blew it all for a couple of really crappy seasons with Fred Hoiberg, who is destined to be kind of, a flyover state college coach for the rest of his life.
So, okay, I hear all of that, and this was a difficult decision between the Bulls and the Sixers, but, like, the way you're framing it, if the Bulls did keep Jimmy, like, if their ceiling isn't a championship contender, then, like, what are we even talking about, right?
Well, they're not,
like,
they're barely in the NBA right now. They're practically a G League franchise. Look,
no,
you could be a second tier Eastern Conference team year after year, and be in the mix, they could have easily been the Eastern Conference Rockets to me if they had played their cards right. You know, you've got that signature star who, you know, he's going to get a little bit of MVP love, a little bit less than Harden, but you know you have a clear style. You're going to be easy to root for. Jimmy's going to bring it every single night. You're going to sell a lot of jerseys. You're going to be a tough out in the playoffs. You are probably going to go out to LeBron every year you face him. But once he leaves, you're going to be in that mix, that group of, hey, like, we've got a shot. And that's way, way, way better than what Chicago's been dealing with. They're trying to talk themselves into Lowry, Markkanen, and a first.
But we both agree that Chicago's front office ownership, coaching, the culture was terrible, regardless of whether they kept Jimmy or not, right? So I don't think that that there was a path to being anything close to the Eastern Conference Houston Rockets in hindsight, because James Harden, perennial MVP candidate, perennial scoring champion, you know, they win 66 games or whatever they did in 2018 in the Western Conference. They get Chris Paul. They have this brilliant front office that engineers that trade, that continuously is ahead of the curve with analytics and keeping cutting edge mentality as an organization. Like, the Bulls just weren't that. The Bulls aren't the Heat either. Like, I'll see that the Heat might be the Eastern Conference version of what the Houston Rockets were at that time period, but the Bulls just could have never done it, which is why I can't put them in terms of the pain that the fan base should feel comparatively to the Philadelphia 76ers fans.
Well, look, if you have a superstar level player, and the thing with Jimmy is, like, from a, you know, a real plus minus standpoint, like, he's pretty consistently like top 5, top 10 type mm-hmm. impact guy, right? So if you have that level of a performer and you identify early that this guy is special, and you resist your temptation to be the most backward thinking front office this side of New York, and you okay. and you start, like, making sound decisions, or if your ownership and you know, deeply understand the game and you realize exactly what you've unearthed, right? And they were just backwards on the Jimmy experience the whole time. They didn't properly value him going into his first extension negotiations. They paid the price for that. I think they probably ruffled his feathers a little bit, you know, through that entire process, making him kind of, you know, go out there and earn his deal, quote unquote, in that breakout season. And then, you know, on top of it, like, if you are going to trade him, you've got to do better than freaking Zach LaVine. I mean, so I just think that, look, there's an alternate universe that they recognize what they have around Jimmy. Their front office is actually baseline competent, and because of the lower standards in the Eastern Conference, they can consistently be like a top 4, top 5 team and win some series in advance a little bit. That's not asking that much in the Eastern Conference, right? It's just like, be a little bit better than the Indiana Pacers. And when you have a talent like Jimmy Butler, you could have done that every year, and they just blew it. Anyway, we've yelled about the Bulls enough. Tell me why the Sixers, for you, are the most painful team to watch. Is it just the proximity of they had them last year and now they don't?
The Sixers were a title contender last year. Jimmy Butler was a humongous reason why they were a title contender and one shot away from advancing to the conference finals, where they could have beat the Milwaukee Bucks and then won the championship because the Golden State Warriors evaporated. So you get rid of this guy who's closing games for you. He's your second most important player easily in a landslide, one of the best two-way players in the league. And you basically are just like, we can't bring him back because of the years, the money, the fact that we made this really dumb trade for Tobias Harris and now we have to pay him, the fact that we have a franchise point guard, power forward, whatever you want to call him, who can't shoot, and so he's thus needs the ball in his hands and is an awkward fit with everybody else in the league, basically. And you just kick Jimmy to the curb and you exchange him for Josh Richardson, you sign Al Horford, and this is where you are now. So, like, you kind of also look at the fact that Jimmy didn't get along with Brett Brown. So, in a way, you also chose Brett Brown over Jimmy, which, sure, I just don't. You knew that Brett Brown was going to be a lame duck if he didn't win the championship or get to the finals anyway. So, I just think that I would have it up to here if I was a Sixers fan and I was watching Jimmy Butler dominate right now, knowing that he was a clear difference maker for my own team the previous season. It's just, it would be too much to swallow for me, honestly, because look, Ben Simmons is never having a 40-point triple-double in the NBA Finals. Like, Tobias Harris is never having a 40-point triple-double in the NBA Finals. These decisions were ridiculous when they happened. They're more ridiculous now, and that's got to be painful.
I'm trying to picture what the conditions would be for a Tobias Harris 40-point triple-double. I'm wondering if it's like they let the kids, you know, the middle school kids play on the court at halftime. Like, maybe that the kids just stay on the court for the second half. Geez. Can you think Tobias could get a 40-point triple-double? The assists would still be hard for him, honestly. I think it would be difficult for him to get to 10 assists there. Great points. Look, it's definitely emblematic of their entire screwed-up decision-making process over the last 2 or 3 years. What's strangest to me is that they got some evidence last year during the playoffs that Jimmy was going to be really helpful in the playoffs, despite all the weird fits, right? Like, who was the guy who you really trusted in last year's playoff run for Philly? To me, it was Jimmy, one, then a gap, then Embiid was really hit or miss in last year's playoffs, right? Some really strange no-shows, dizzy, dealing with injury issues, sickness, all these other questions. So he's two. And then Simmons is barely rating because, you know, who knows what he's doing in the playoffs, right? So, like, you had evidence right there in front of you who is the most important person. Now, you obviously have bigger long-term concerns. You've got the egos. You've got the marketing and the positioning and the interpersonal dynamics where, you know, I think that group was, like, a little bit mentally tougher than the Minnesota Timberwolves, but not that much mentally tougher, right? And, you know, Jimmy was the easy fall guy because he was so demanding and he was trying to pull them to a standard they didn't want to necessarily go to, or they didn't feel like they could go to as a group. And you can include Brett Brown in that as well. I mean, it's just, again, personality conflicts. Brett Brown is not as meek as Fred Hoiberg, but he's like halfway there. He's main nice, I guess I would put it that way, right?
Well, real quick, like, Josh Richardson comes from Miami, right? And goes to Philly, and right after the season ends, he says that Brett Brown does not hold players accountable. So what does that tell you?
Right. Well, he's also used to Spoelstra, so I mean that is you know, that's a different standard. It just tells you that Miami plays by one set of rules. I mean, they're measuring guys' body fat and, like, you know, they're running guys into the ground. It's certainly different in Miami, but yeah, there's no question. You know, just culture wise, you know, Philly has been not good enough these last couple of years. And again, you're supposed to have some high level decision maker analyzing the talent, analyzing the performance in the big moments and saying, look, if we want this thing to really go, there's one person who we can trust here. And it's definitely not Tobias Harris. And somehow they came out of that one completely backwards. All right, let's do one final Jimmy Butler ranking before we move on here. When you're looking at the other forwards and wings around the league, where do you have Jimmy at this point in terms of your rankings? And who's definitely above him, and then who's in that same tier maybe as him? And, like, if you're drafting, where does he fall?
Yeah, so, I mean, I hinted at this before, and I can't remember if we talked about it on an earlier episode or not, but I just think that what makes Jimmy so fascinating is he kind of defies the player rankings. He makes them more dumb than they normally are.
Not there dumb, guys, Michael. I made my name on the top 100.
I know. I apologize. Your top 100s hold a special place in my heart. And
not
the heart
only
of
intelligent,
millions.
But flawless is what people would usually say about them.
I wouldn't go that far. But, you know, I think that there are guys who are clearly better than him in his position who I don't think could have done what he did in this specific situation in Miami. Like, I think Kevin Durant is better. I think Kawhi Leonard is better. I think LeBron James is better. But do all of those guys let Kendrick Nunn lead the Miami Heat in shots during the regular season, knowing it's probably best for the team? Or let Bam Adebayo in his first season as a starter, full-time starter, you know, bring the ball up the court and initiate offense from the elbow? Does KD and Kawhi and LeBron, do they let Tyler Hero run pick and rolls and take shots that no rookie should ever attempt and encourage it? So I just think it's really difficult to, and this is with all, you know, contextual player ratings and rankings and how we kind of view all this stuff. But I just think Jimmy is such a special situation, and this is such a special case, because if you asked me, I would say, you know, if I'm trying to pick a player to start a team, he's probably like, he's somewhere in the top 12, but he's behind a certain set of players that, you know, he's in like kind of a second tier. He's not a superstar in my eyes.
So yeah, you're hitting on a lot of the top 100 dilemmas that we face. So I think for this particular ranking, this is not about starting a franchise for the next 15 mm-hmm. years, because obviously you're going to take mm-hmm. a guy like Jason Tatum over Jimmy Butler in that situation, yes. right? This is, in a, you know, we also talk about the vacuum test, right? Where yeah. you have to imagine Jimmy Butler on a random group, not necessarily the best culture fit for him in the entire right. NBA, which is like the currently the Miami Heat, right? So the average situation for him is probably something closer to like Philly, where, you know, you've got poor situation in Minnesota, you know, and then you've got some other situation. Like if you went to Phoenix, you could just know that that would be a disaster right off the top, right? Sacramento Kings, it would never work, right? So somewhere in the middle is like Philly, and then Miami is that perfect situation. So if you're taking Jimmy Butler in an average vacuum with an average collection of teammates for a one-year exercise, right? So like basically, like say starting in October and coming forward into these playoffs, who mm-hmm. is definitely above him?
We're doing just wings, or we're doing this everybody?
Yeah, wings is great.
Okay, so I mean LeBron, obviously Kawhi. I guess Giannis is a wing. I don't even know what Giannis is, but I'll say that Giannis is ahead of Jimmy. Luka. Do you have yep. Luka above Jimmy?
For
yeah,
sure.
I'm sure you do. Yeah.
Luka and Kevin Durant, obviously, who's injured, yep. would both be there.
Yep. Yep. I have KD above him. I have Harden above him also.
So I consider him more of a point, but that's fine. Yes. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, 6'7". Yeah, sure. And then, I mean, I don't really have anyone who's clearly ahead. I have other guys kind of in the mix in the lower tier. You know, Paul George. Gordon Hayward. No, I'm just kidding. Jason Tatum is definitely in that tier for me still. And then just like other types of players, you know, like I have Dame in this tier. I have Chris Paul in this tier. I have Joel Embiid in this tier. So that's kind of just how I view Jimmy, just like in the with the vacuum test that we're doing right now.
No, we're pretty much aligned. I mean, I think that the tier below Jimmy looks something like Tatum, Chris Middleton, Paul George, not necessarily in that order, probably Tatum, then Paul George, then Chris Middleton. But I think the only guys who are definitively above Jimmy are like the A-list MVP candidate every year guys. LeBron, yep. KD, Kawhi, Luka, if you want to call them those wings, Giannis. I mean, I think that's the group. So that's a pretty special place for him to be in. And I do think that like, one takeaway I had from game three is that, you know, I should have known, and we all should have known, that Jimmy wouldn't go out that quietly, right? He's never gone quietly. He's, you know, he's always making noise on his way out of every situation, and he is a very, very talented player, and he will give every single thing he's got, even if it leaves him laying on the hardwood multiple times, and even if he's playing through the sprained ankle from game one, and even if he doesn't have two of his best teammates who are injured. He's going to bring it, and he made up for the significant talent gap between those two teams in Game 3. And I do think that, you know, with this podcast here, we've tried to, you know, salute him for doing that. All right, Michael, we've gone on way, way too long about Jimmy Butler, but hey, that happens. I did want to double back on one question we got from last week. We got so excited talking about Celtics trolling that I forgot to answer Tom from Australia's question. He says, could Ben please talk more about what life is like in the bubble right now, especially as the number of teams has decreased? It's a great question, Tom. I wrote about this last week. I did an interview with the NBA's deputy commissioner, Mark Tatum, that included some of the NBA's closing thoughts on the bubble experience, but it also just tried to wrap up what things are like here now that we've reached October. So be sure to check out that piece. It will have even more details. I can tell you first off, I mean, when we first got here in July, it was just bustling. There's probably roughly one-third as many people here now as there was back then. When you walk around to exercise, for example, a lot of the people who I was seeing every single day, Brad Stevens, Michael Malone, I mean, you know, those types, you know, Tim Connolly of the Nuggets, they've all gone home sort of one by one by one. So the oval walking track that we all use has gotten, you know, significantly emptier here over the last couple of days. I've also noticed this is more of like a naturalist type thing, Michael, but the seasons have changed. So a lot of the animal life that I was seeing in, you know, kind of the peak of summer is now gone. The butterflies have moved on for, I guess, probably warmer pastures. And we are left with, I saw a deer the other night. I saw a raccoon. I saw a hawk just sitting on the side of the road looking like he wanted some dinner. I'm just seeing different things out there that you would normally expect. And I think in part because they're reclaiming Disney World. They're like, there's nobody here. This is our turf, right? So the animals are kind of like coming for us in a certain way, which has been kind of fun. I think you're also seeing from the NBA a deep paranoia, if you want to call it that, you know, ultra vigilance. They really want this thing to end with no positive tests. That is something that they have made a gigantic priority. So we are getting extra text message alerts every single day about what is and isn't allowed. They've tightened up some rules. They don't want us eating or drinking really at the arena anymore because they're trying to make sure there's no positive tests. They've just taken things, just ramped it up. And it could be in part because NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has now joined the bubble and they're trying to, you know, hold everything to the highest possible standard with the boss in town. That would be totally understandable. But there has been kind of like a recommitment to all these strict rules that we've been living under. They have opened up certain parts of the campus that we didn't previously have access to. So I actually was able to walk into the Disney gift store. I had not been there since July, Michael, when they were doing July 4th decorations. It's now in full Halloween mode. I can't tell you how trippy that was to realize that like 3 months just poof went by. I was glad it wasn't Christmas decorations, I'll be honest, because that would have really, really thrown me for a loop. You know, past that, I think that you're getting a lot of weariness. A lot of people looking like zombies. I'll confess, I was counting the days here. When we were getting down to the possibility of a sweep, I had to scramble and make, you know, travel reservations, which now have had to be changed. But it kind of snuck up on us pretty quickly. I was doing a great job of not counting the days until LA won game one. And then all of a sudden, you know, it became clear, hey, we might not be here for the full seven game series. You know, what's the next step? So I think there's a lot of that going on. A lot of people missing their kids and wanting to get back as quickly as possible. I think that's the general sense of the bubble. I wouldn't say it's negative. I would just say that this experience has sort of run its course. It does feel like we're getting pretty close to everybody, you know, being ready to go home and to call it a wrap and to call it a win. And at the same time, you're getting, you know, this real vibe from the league of, hey, let's finish strong. Let's run through the tape. Let's make sure we don't let up and have the final spoiled by, a, you know, a positive test or something else like that.
So I hope that, you know, if our listeners take one thing away from everything that you just said, it's that butterflies fly south for the winter, which I didn't know, Ben. So thank you for enlightening me on that topic.
Well, they have migratory patterns. I mean, I guess I should really dig in to know exactly where they're going, but certainly there is a, you know, transition element for them, and they've transitioned the heck out of Disney World. I can say that because I love photographic butterflies, and there's probably 5% as many right now in October as there was back in July, and all the most beautiful ones are out of here, Michael. And that's going to be the same way for reporters, by the way. You know, within about a week or two, all the most beautiful reporters like myself are going to be getting up out of Walt Disney World after a three-month stay. I'll also say this, Tom. One aspect of bubble life that I've really found, especially as soon as the finals started, I got an awful lot of text messages from people saying, wait a minute, you're still at Disney World? How long have you been there? And I do think, you know, this the marathon element to this bubble experience for more casual people, for, you know, non-Open Floor Globe members who obviously you guys are locked into every show and paying attention every step of the way, you know, throughout the playoffs and the regular season restart and the scrimmages and, you know, all the buildup. I think for casual fans who are maybe, you know, seeing NFL games now, seeing college football games on, and then realizing the NBA is somehow still playing, I think for them, it feels like I've been in here for like a year, and I can understand that too. I mean, the Groundhog Day element to this entire experience is something that will always stick with me.
It's kind of reminds me of like being at Summer League towards the end, and just how, I mean, for me personally, it's super depressing. I've only been there on the last day once, I think, in my career. But it's so bleak when you think about like the start and how many more people were there and just different energies. So that's the only thing I could really relate it to. Is it kind of like that? Because I know you've been for the whole shebang in Vegas many times.
Yeah, no doubt. Look, it definitely felt like that, especially during game two, which is easily the flattest finals game I will ever attend in my entire life, and nothing will be close to it. I mean, that felt like a preseason game, like a summer league game. It felt like one of the scrimmages where they were barely even keeping score when we first got here to the bubble. It was such a strange and just like energy sucked out of the building type experience because of Miami's injuries and because of how easy LA was kind of doing everything that it wanted to do. So it's certainly comparable to the end of the summer league there. I would say that, you know, game three changed the dynamic here a little bit, right? It puts some pressure on the Lakers. I think it's going to get some people locked back into the series. They're going to have to prove some stuff. But I also think that there's even a greater level of weariness and just, you know, people are exhausted, mentally exhausted, physically exhausted. You know, just to give you an example, Tom, like there's supposed to be a dinner, you know, tonight that the NBA is organizing for us, which is always welcome news because the food here on a daily basis isn't really the best. And so anytime we get a special dinner, it's always a big treat. And I'll be honest, just sitting here at almost 1 p.m., I don't even know if I want to go. I've already seen these people for three months. I think I might just want to go walk in circles around the property and take some photos of whatever butterfly I could find, Michael. It's just like one of those things where you're just so worn down. I'm not trying to whine about it. I'm not trying to complain about it. I'm just trying to give you the sensation here in the bubble, which is we've all been here a long time. You know, we can see the finish line. It's almost taunting us. And, you know, I think from that standpoint, it's hard to explain to people who aren't down here. And I think Chris Paul made that point to me, you know, more than a month ago when he was hailing Michelle Roberts for, you know, committing her entire, you know, 3 months to this experience of living in the bubble, that he just felt like the leaders needed to be down here going through it and really getting it and understanding what they were putting the players through. And I feel the same way. I'm going to do my absolute best to convey the bubble experience in my book, which you can pre-order on Amazon, Bubble Ball. But it's very difficult. And I know that sounded kind of sad, not trying to take shots at any of my colleagues. We've just seen an awful lot of each other. And, you know, home is calling our names.
Yeah, well, it's almost over, Ben. You're almost home free. You've done a tremendous job. I was watching The Shining over the weekend just because it's October, getting in the mood. And I couldn't help but think about how that movie relates to your situation in a lot of ways. So almost home free, my friend.
I appreciate that. All right, man. I think on that very dark and depressing note, we should call it the end of another Open Floor podcast. Guys, we got a bunch of questions, but send them in. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. We will double back later this week after having seen game four. Will the Lakers take control? Will the series even up? We'll dig into all of that. And we'll take your questions that are non-finals questions. I know some of you guys are looking forward. Some of you are asking hypothetical, you know, big picture type questions. We're glad to address those as well. Let us know what's on your mind. We don't have too much basketball to discuss, Michael. We're almost headed into what could be a pretty long offseason, so keep those questions coming. We're always glad to tackle anything you've got. All right, we are on Apple Podcasts, so search for us. Type in Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. I am on Twitter at Ben.Golliver. If you want more Jimmy Butler talk, check out my Washington Post newsletter. It will be posting Monday. It's free every Monday. Check it out and be sure to follow our coverage at WashingtonPost.com/sports. Michael is on Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. Follow what he's doing at 538 and GQ. All right, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.